The following is a teaching by Dr. Ken Boa from the Leadership Series on the subject of communicating vision.
Years ago, there was a story in Reader's Digest, so it must be true, about a fellow who was stuck in a 1957 Chevy stick shift on the side of the road in I-95 in Connecticut. And with his hood up, he was looking at trying to investigate the problem. A good Samaritan comes up to him and says, "Can I be of help?" He says, "I think I need a push at about 50 miles an hour." And so the guy gets in his car and waits a few minutes and nervously looks in his rearview mirror and waiting for the guy to come and give him a push, sees the guy coming at him at 50 miles an hour. Talk about whiplash. The fact is, communication can mean a good deal in certain situations. There was a story about a guy who was bringing a large appliance. It was a washing machine. He had it on the threshold of his door in a residential area, and another fellow came by and saw him struggling with his washing machine, so he offered to help him out. And after about 5 minutes of continual struggle at the threshold of the door, they were both totally exhausted, and one of them said, the guy who came to help him said, "My word, I don't know if we'll ever get this thing into your house." "Into my house? I'm trying to get the thing out of my house." 5 minutes of working at cross purposes. Communication can make a great deal of difference in our lives. Or a father talking to his 3.5-year-old son, and the son asked him, "Daddy, why is my apple turning brown?" As he's chewing into the thing, and his father says, "Because after you ate the skin off, the meat of the apple came to contact with the air, which caused it to oxidize, thus changing its molecular structure and turning it into a different color." Well, after a long silence, the son said softly, "Daddy, are you talking to me?" Once again, communication makes a big difference. But let me tell you a story, one of my favorites about communication. It's the great conductor Arturo Toscanini. And they were rehearsing for Debussy's La Mer. And he wanted a particularly sublime effect in one spot, and he was at a loss for words to communicate what he was looking for. But then he had an inspired idea. He took his handkerchief out of his pocket and threw the white handkerchief up in the air, and as the audience watched it delicately float down in mesmerized attention, he said to the orchestra players, "There, play it like that." You see, the idea of play it like that with this movement, this flow, which is very, very appropriate to the kind of music that would be involved. I want to talk about communication this time and also the next time we're together. And today I want to talk about the issue of communication of vision. To communicate vision is one of the key qualities of a leader. And when we are called to leadership, we are called to have a vision. And we've talked about vision already, but then how do you communicate that vision? How do you impart that in such a way that others begin to catch the vision that you have, to catch your passion for your life? And there are some who can communicate well and others who do not. Speaking of a certain lawyer, Abraham Lincoln once said, "He can compress the most words into the smallest ideas better than any man I ever met." And there are people who compress a lot of words into small ideas. And what you want to be able to do is to take your words and make them effective and to communicate not just words, but something that goes beyond the words. There's something of a passion of yourself. Communication involves not just words, but the personality. It involves character. It involves the ethos of a life. There is this whole idea of a logos, which is the words, the concepts. There is the ethos, which is the way of being, the way you are. And there's pathos, which is the issue of your passion, that there is a sympathy as well. And combining knowing logos and being ethos, and the doing actually would be the ethos, and the pathos would be the being. Combining those different dimensions of your life in such a way that they are coherent And part of communicating vision is when there's a congruence between who you are, how you are, and what you claim, so that there's a coherence, there's a congruence between the two. There's an integrity, so that your character and your words, the more they match, the more persuasive you become in sharing your vision. And I'd like us to turn to 1 Chronicles 28, verses 1 to 21, to illustrate this idea of communicating vision. And sometimes rhetoric can be important, and the way you express the words themselves. I mean, I came across something a couple of years ago, and it had famous sayings with the rhetoric removed. Here's one: should I live or what? What's the better way of putting that? Should I live or what? What's that from? To be or not to be. A little bit different image, isn't that? Hamlet's soliloquy. How about this one? What I'm sorry about is that I can't die for my country two or three times. Nathan Hale. I only regret that I have what? One life to lose for my country. I'll be back someday. That sounds a little bit more like Arnold Schwarzenegger, I'll be back, than General Douglas MacArthur, I shall return. Or how about this particular line here? It was the best time in history, but it was sort of bad too. There's a better way than that. Yes, it was a great line from the Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. That's an amazing novel because it's bookended with two very, very gripping images. Not only that, but at the end, can you remember how it concludes? It is a far, far better thing that I do than I've ever done before. You know, that idea when he is about to really sacrifice himself. The greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. And Dickens bookends that imagery. Communicating vision is very critical. And David wanted to build the temple. He had a passion to build a temple, but God told him that you are a man of bloodshed and of warfare, and it will not be you who builds this temple, but it'll be your son Solomon. And even his name Solomon comes from shalom, having to do with peace, that Solomon would reign in a context of peace. And so it would be his task, David's task, in 1 Chronicles 28, to communicate this vision. And what's significant is that David chose not to view himself as having been cut out of the action, but instead he energetically took on this new charge, and he saw himself of communicating a vision in such a way that it would infect Solomon and enlist his unqualified support. So he saw himself really being a part of what his successor would undertake, which is another issue, the idea of succession and of preparing. It's very interesting that in various organizations, whether they are secular organizations, whether they are Christian organizations, the idea of preparing for your successor is very, very critical. And to make sure that the baton handoff is a smooth one is very, very wise for us to see that we have a particular opportunity to continue to invest in something even when we are beginning to let go of it, and to communicate that and to bring it to the next generation. That's what I love about the vision of the gospel, is that it's an unbroken vision from the first century. In effect, we're living in Acts chapter 29. In Acts 28, it ends very abruptly. I don't know if you've noticed that, but at the end of Acts 28, Paul is there in house arrest. He has freedom to have people visit him. And he's got a Roman guard chained to him, which is quite an interesting thing, because I rather doubt that Roman guard had much of a chance when you think about Paul the evangelist, and he's chained to this guy. So one guy after another is also hearing this message. But all of a sudden, it stops. Paul's waiting for the outcome of his trial and so forth, and he's been there for 2 years, and it just stops, which indicates that Luke stopped the work right about that time during Paul's first Roman imprisonment around the year 62 AD. And what's significant is you can pick up from evidence of the pastoral epistles, 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, that Paul evidently was released and had an opportunity to travel some more, because he actually visited places and did things that aren't recorded in the book of Acts. So evidently he was freed and then had a second Roman imprisonment. The point that I'm saying there, though, is that while Acts stops, there's something about that abrupt ending where really it's kind of an open end rather than a closed end. And it's almost to imply that there's a sense in which the book of Acts continues on. Namely, this message has been communicated, this vision has been imparted from generation to generation, from one changed life to the next, unbroken succession now for 2,000 years. And the thing that communicates it is that each generation has a task to communicate it to the next. And one of the things I would encourage us to do, we have a range of men in this room. Some of us haven't had kids yet. Some of us have young children. Some of us have older kids, teenagers. You know, that oblong plate in the. You remember, those of you who are old enough to remember Ed Sullivan. They used to bring this guy on, and he'd spin plates, and he'd spin one, and then get another one going, and so forth. When you have a teenager, you have these oblong dinner plates. They don't work like the other plates do. They're very different. And there's that bizarre period of time, but then somehow we survive that adolescence, although the strange thing in our culture is we're continuing adolescence to the 30s in some cases. But as we get older, and as our kids get older, we see that there are different seasons and circumstances in our life, and that when we reach a certain point in our life, we're called to start mentoring. And start imparting what we have received and to invest that in the next generation. And that is part of this idea of imparting vision as well. So there's this concept there of our taking our life message and infecting others with that message and in such a way that we can communicate that well. In 1 Chronicles 28, David communicates his plans for the temples, and I won't go through the reading of the whole chapter, but the essential elements are that first, he made it clear that the vision had come from God, and secondly, he informed Solomon that his role would be to lead the charge in building the temple. This task would require a real devotion to God and to the work, and a half-baked effort wasn't going to do it. And so he tries to instill confidence and vision in his son Solomon, and then he assured the people that God himself would enable Solomon to get the job done. And then also, later in the text, particularly verses 11 to 19, David gave his son sufficient detail about the temple so that Solomon could visualize what it would look like. There is a need for also being clear and to communicate that. And then finally, after casting the vision, he gave his son another dose of encouragement. And the idea, again, is to ask yourself what it takes to infect others with your organizational vision, the vision that you have for your company, the vision that you have for your life. This is a skill that can be imparted in any context and in any setting. The Bible is a very vision-casting book that invites us not only to look ahead to God's promises in the future, but also to participate in their realization in the present tense. And we're called to be a people who are building or kingdom builders and who we see ourselves as having a slice of the action, as being a people who are privileged to participate in something that will have lingering effects. I've often thought that the answer to the question, how significant is it, is probably related to the question, how long will it last? So that the idea of significance relates to something that will endure. And the more significant it is, the longer it will endure. I believe God has wired you and me to long for significance. And I believe it's because He's planted eternity in your heart that what you really long for is for your life to have meant something. In fact, so much that it will have eternal reverberations, eternal consequences. Fortunately, God has equipped us for that very reason, to be able to invest eternal, timeless truth. Your word is truth. Your word is true from generation to generation into eternal beings, namely human beings who will continue on. And as we realize this, you've never met a mere mortal. This is a very important concept for you to embrace, that human beings, God has created us in His image, and thus we will endure. And if you invest God's eternal truth into eternal beings, you can, in fact, be a person who participates in something that will last forever. In other words, you do not want to give your life in exchange for something that God says is going to burn up in the end. You want to make sure that in your desire to acquire wealth and acquire various things, that that's not the end, but a vehicle or a means so that you can ultimately build a life message that you're investing in the next generation, in people, so that you are serving people well by in being empowered and energized by an eternal vision rather than just a temporal vision, rather than just writing your name in the sand. You're writing your name in hearts. John chapter 4, verse 35, in the story of the woman at the well, after she goes off to tell the Samaritan people, her countrymen, about a man who's told her about everything she's ever done, and she's concluded that this must be the prophet from God, the Messiah, in fact. Jesus then tells his disciples who've come back from looking to go to get some food, and as they come back, he says, I have food to eat that you don't know anything about, in verse 32. And the disciples said to each other, could someone have brought him food? My food, Jesus said, is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work. Do you not say 4 months more and then the harvest? I tell you, open your eyes and look at the fields. They are ripe for harvest. It's possible that at this particular point, the men from Samaria were actually coming because of the women's testimony. And it may be that he's looking and seeing them come in the distance, and he tells them to look up and to see that the fields are already white for harvest, the harvest being the human souls. The concept here, at least, is this, that the nourishment that we are called to engage in is participation in God's will. And to communicate a greater vision of God's will to his disciples is one of the real things that Jesus sought to achieve. He sought to build into his life and to communicate a vision of God's purposes and to give them a vision that surpasses human comprehension, but thus it must be communicated by the Spirit of God. We saw already in the life of Elisha how this was the case. When the Arameans tried to capture the prophet, his servant despaired and saying, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And he wringing his hand in despair, and Elisha communicated a vision of God's control over the situation. He says, don't be afraid. Those who are with us are more than those who are with them. And then he said, he prayed, O Lord, open his eyes so that he may see. And then the Lord opened the servant's eyes and he saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. And so the idea here is that you see a vision in a new way. He saw it from God's perspective. In the same way, Paul told the Corinthians, the person without the Spirit doesn't accept the things that are from the Spirit of God because they are foolish to him and he cannot understand them because they are spiritually discerned, 1 Corinthians 2:14. 2 Corinthians 4:4, the God of this age has blinded the minds of unbelievers so that they can't see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. The vision, the spiritual vision about who Jesus is and about life in him is something that must be imparted not just by us, but by the Spirit working in us and through us, so that we become people who are dependent upon the Spirit of God to impart a personal vision for building God's kingdom. So in that light, then, we are called to be people who build vision and communicate that well into the lives of others. A second text I'd like you to consider would be Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 to 9, one of the most important passages in all of Scripture about the idea of inculcating wisdom in the lives of our children. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 to 9. Again, what we are called to do, I believe, is to communicate the vision of newness of life to others within our spheres of influence. All of us have been given a sphere of influence. And I believe that you and I are called as leaders to communicate God's vision to people within our sphere of leadership and influence. To do that in a natural, incarnational way. And to do it in a way that is meaningful and personal. And the most important aspect of our sphere of leadership is our family. And considering that, Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 to 9, starts off with the great Shema, which means to hear. And Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Eloheinu Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. And he says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. Then he goes on to say, these commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home, when you walk along the road, when you lie down, and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. What it's telling us to do is to impart a vision of the Lord your God. The Lord your God, the Lord is one. First of all, he says, you shall love him with all your heart, soul, and with your strength. You cannot impart what you don't possess. And so before a father can communicate spiritual truth to his children, it must be a reality in his own life. It must not be by acquaintance, by hearsay rather, but by knowledge, by an intimate knowledge. And so he's saying basically, you can't give away what you don't possess. Parents must first know and love God before they can hope to instill spiritual truth in the hearts of the next generation. And that's why he says, these commandments that I give you today are to be upon your heart. That is to say, it's to be a reality with you. My experience growing up was one of parents. My dad never went to church when I was very young. He sent us off to church. And there was a situation there where there seemed to be a disparity between what he wanted us to do and what he was in his life. In fact, he even had the classic statement here, don't do as I say, as I do, but as I say, do as I say, not as I do. That's something wrong about that. There's a lack of coherence, a lack of congruence there. But the fact is that I observed that they never went to church, but they farmed us off. So on the one hand, they thought that was a value, but apparently not a big enough value for them to embrace. So it was really one of those kinds of things that really didn't really have integrity. It didn't really infect us at that point in our journey. The reality is then that in communicating vision, it has to be first of all in us. And then he talks about this vision being imparted in both formal and informal ways. And in the formal ways, it says in structured settings, when you sit at home. And so as he puts it this way, talk about them when you sit at home. But then he also says, and when you walk down along the road. So there are informal times. There'll be times when you sit down and share and instruct, but there are other times when there are opportunities that are unexpected and you communicate these visions. You tie them, he says, when you lie down and when you get up. So it's supposed to be something that's in the communication of your life, in the laboratory of life, that you incarnate and you exhibit that of which you speak. And so for you and I to be true leaders, we need to embrace a vision and begin to incarnate that and to exhibit it and to desire that to be something that's part of our very being so that it's conveyed as much through our character as it is through the words that we speak. Truth is effectively proclaimed when there's a consistency of words and works. I'd think of Proverbs chapter 2, and the whole idea here in Proverbs 2 is, my son, to accept my words and store up my commands within you, turning your ear to wisdom and applying your heart to understanding. The whole chapter is trying to create a thirst for wisdom, a desire for seeing life from God's side. And so as I see that then, this is a way of living, a way of being. Another text I want us to consider is Moses, when God commissions him at the burning bush in Exodus chapter 3 and 4. Moses has a number of objections. In fact, there are five objections that Moses raises to God's commissioning. There when he says, I want you to go in Exodus chapter 3, and I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. He is given a particular calling, and God now needs to overcome Moses' objection to this particular vision. He was daunted by the mission to which God was calling him. But God had to ensure him that he would empower him to accomplish something that Moses couldn't do. Frankly, it's my belief that God's particular purpose for your life, not the world's purpose, but God's purpose for your life, because you have one, will not be achieved unless you seek to fulfill it in his power, in his timing, and in his way. It has to be in his timing, his power, and in his way. And I believe that all of us have a particular purpose in life that we are called to fulfill that will reverberate forever. And it'll have to do with your sphere of influence, and it'll have to do with a life message that he is crafting in you. And as you receive that message and develop that, you begin to impart that, and you begin to incarnate that so that there's a coherence between who you are and what you do, that your ministry flows out of your being. And I want to stress that this has nothing to do with whether you are in full-time Christian service or not. We're all called to full-time engagement in kingdom business. At our work, at our home, in our arenas of influence, there's no sacred secular distinction. What becomes, as I said before, what appears to be secular becomes spiritual when the focus of your heart is the eternal. So that if your focus of your heart is on the things that are going to last, ultimately, and if you seek that to be the focus of your heart, then secular things take on the note of the spirit, and it becomes something that's transcendent. There's a transcendent moment that can take place. This can happen in any number of circumstances. I have a book that Karen and I did called A Light for My Path. Some of you have it, and it's a simple little book. People, when they say, I think I ought to start reading the Bible, the worst thing I can do is start at Genesis and try to go from Genesis to Revelation. It's a killer exercise, and rarely is it done well. Because you get through Genesis and Exodus, and you're okay. But what happens when you hit Leviticus? You start dying. You're reading about scabs, and you're reading about these bizarre experiences there, and it's not a really pleasant book to read about sacrifices and so forth. And you may escape from Leviticus, but then you hit Deuteronomy. You say, I know I've read that before, and because it's the retelling of the law. Then you get in, you wonder what happened to the storyline when you get into the poets and the prophets, and it doesn't make a lot of sense to people. Rarely do they succeed in making it through. So we decided to create a little tool, a guided tour of the Bible. And this guided tour of the Bible takes the 365 key chapters of the Bible, and it guides you in 365 days from Genesis to Revelation and keeps you from getting bogged down and gives you a narrative, and it tells you what you're going to read and then tells you the chapter to read, and then there's a prayer of application, and we found it to be helpful. I just had my hair cut, or as my grandmother used to put it, my ears lowered the other day. I think it was Monday. And you never know what's going to happen. The last time I was there, I gave a copy of that book to the guy who was doing my hair. And I noticed he was there, but I had someone else was doing my hair this time. And as I was about to leave, he says, aren't you Ken? Ken Bowie says, yeah, I'm up to Numbers. So he says, I'm reading the book that you gave me. I'm up to Numbers. Now, I know he's not lying, because he wouldn't be able to just make that up. I'm up to Numbers. And the other said, what book is this? And then so I went ahead and gave a copy of that book to the two women, one who did my hair and her friend. Now, four of them, because there was someone else I gave a copy to. That simple a thing. The little book like that can be taking that little moment and turning it into something very meaningful. I only made sure that I said, I'm not going to give you this unless you promise to read it. That's the only condition. So I know, it's called A Light for My Path. It's a guided tour of the Bible, basically. In fact, there's only one chapter in Leviticus. So, but in fact, chapter 6. But it's the best chapter, and I try to summarize the book. Every book of the Bible is represented in this, but it guides you through. But the point is this: I had prayed when I was in my chair, and I don't want to force the thing. I'm not one of these people who can just manipulate this. I have some friends who can do this very well. I got a friend with the gift of personal evangelism. I've told you about guys like this before. They can share the gospel with somebody, with a complete stranger in an elevator, and by the time they got to the top, they've got their life history and they've shared the gospel. If I scripted that, they'd punch me out. Somehow they get away with this. The guy sits next to you in the airplane, and they immediately get him. Some people are very good at this. I don't want to force the issue, but I pray for the opportunity, and I did. And just at that moment, the opportunity came. And so all I'm saying is that there's no moment in your life that cannot be infused if we desire God's purposes with something that is beyond. And there is the communication of a vision and a calling that we have, all of us, to fulfill His purposes. Moses was told to take the people out of Egypt. And to take all those slaves out of Egypt, Pharaoh, you know, that's good labor. And he was not exactly going to be thrilled about having all these slaves removed from Egypt. And so his first objection is, who am I, he says, that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? This is in Exodus chapter 3, verse 11. By the way, that question implies a very radical change in Moses' direction here in his life, because earlier he'd impulsively taken it upon himself to vindicate a fellow Hebrew for a beating he'd endured from an Egyptian. Now he feels inadequate for the task. That's probably good, because he now realizes it's something that now God will have to do for him. His second objection, verse 13, is, well, what am I supposed to tell them? And just as God said, look, I'll take care of the other situation, because God plus one equals a majority, what shall I tell them? And God answers that by saying, I am who I am. You're going to tell the Israelites, I am sent me to you. And so he gives them an authority that will underlie. He is the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, a description that would resonate with the slaves in Egypt. Third question in chapter 4, verse 1, is what if they do not believe me? Because he remembered when he tried to adjudicate a dispute between these two Hebrew slaves. And you recall one of the Hebrew men scornfully asked, who made you a ruler and a judge over us? Are you the one who killed the Egyptian and tried to bury him? And then he knew the matter was known and he fled. So he, of course, still has those words after 40 years still rolling around in his mind, and the fear of rejection would be there. God told Moses that he would validate his leadership through a series of miracles and would convince even the most skeptical person in Egypt. So the point here is that God is assuring him and overcoming his objections. His next objection was that he wasn't qualified to lead the people because he wasn't an eloquent speaker. Chapter 4, verse 10. Lord, I've never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I'm slow of speech and of tongue. And God said to him, who gave man his mouth? Who makes him deaf or mute? Who gives him sight or makes him blind? It is not I, the Lord. Now go, I'll speak, help you speak, and I will teach you what to say. Moses' final objection, God angry. He says, Lord, please send someone else to do it. Send somebody else. I don't want to do it. The point here is that God has to overcome that as well. And in this situation here, he assures him that indeed you are a man who is given a particular calling, a purpose, a vision, a destiny. And I would say, like all leaders, we will face tough challenges. Like Moses, we will seem to find ourselves in impossible situations. At such times, we need to follow this passage to assess the situations and take your fears to God, to listen to God's response and then obey what he has to say. The way I take my fears to God and listen to his response is that I open this book and I invite the Spirit of God to speak to me. I take my fears, my concerns, my anxieties, my worries at that situation, and by staying in this book and actually openly and honestly communicating my concerns to him, I am asking him for his vision for my life. I'm asking him to fill me and to speak to me in the pages of this book. And it's like no other book, the Spirit of God. The Word of God is alive and active and sharper than any two-edged sword. It's able to pierce into the deepest part of the soul and to convict us, to encourage us, to comfort us, and to strengthen us. All of us at this table have challenges, problems, fears, anxieties. We're many of us worried about the future. We're looking at an uncertain economy. We're looking at financial concerns. We're looking at emotional problems, relational concerns. We are dealing with physical issues. And all of us are in an arena of uncertainty. We are really finding ourselves in context from time to time when we realize that life seems to be hung on the most gossamer of threads. And it seems that one small thing there, a minute there, a second there, a little situation here and there, all could make all the difference in the world. In such a context, you and I need the assurance of God's vision, that he has a purpose for your life. Let me tell you that as a follower of Jesus, you are immortal until God's purpose for your life is achieved. And it may be that you can achieve God's purpose for your life in only a few years. It may be all it takes. Some of us take a little bit longer. Some of us might require 80, 90 years to fulfill that purpose. Some of us are taken out quite young. Some of us, and I've known some people who say, gosh, I've been around so long, and they actually become world weary. I've known some folks in that situation. Let me tell you that God has a purpose for you. And if you have survived, as I have from several near-death kinds of experiences, a variety of experiences, I will not regale you with those stories, that have been brought me very near to death. In fact, that those situations caused me to review my life and realize I'm not ready yet. There's something that must continue. There's unfinished business. And He would save my life from that situation. I realize that all of our lives are in that thread, and we are here for a purpose. In fact, you have probably been spared things you don't even know about, that you can't control. And I'm saying here, God's got you here and now in this planet for a purpose. And let me end with this thought, something that I often want to share. I believe that your purpose and mine is twofold. First of all, to become more conformed to the image of His Son, to become actually shaped, a soul-forming world. And secondly, it is to reproduce that life, the life of Christ, in the lives of others. And I believe that you and I both have that dual vision, to become more like His Son, to become an incarnation of His truth, and secondly, to reproduce that truth in the life of others. Let me share with you this reality. When you stand in His presence, you'll never again have the opportunity to share the gospel with those who are in need, to serve those who are in pain and in sorrow and in loss. That opportunity is only now. And so I would say for us, in light of that future, to relish the opportunities of the presence by understanding that right now counts forever, so that we have an eternal vision, and to realize you do not want to squander and fritter away this precious opportunity in this life and exchange your life for toys, tinsel, and trinkets, and to give your life in exchange for things that God says will all burn away. Instead, ask God for His vision for your life so that you will use your remaining years well, and so that we invest our lives and give them in exchange for what God declares to be important. And what does He declare to be important? Only two things that go on into eternity. What are they again? Word of God and people. So you want to make sure that your life counts. And there's not a person in this room who doesn't have an opportunity to learn this book and then to live this book and to impart these truths in the lives of the people that God has sovereignly placed in your sphere of influence.
This concludes Dr. Ken Boa's teaching. For more information about Reflections Ministries, please visit us on the web at www.reflectionsministries.org.